Jeremy, and Lila. I am addressing this letter to you all, but my greatest hope is that you, Joe, will read this. I have many long roads to walk, but the road to you remains my longest and most difficult. As I write this, my head is flooded with the memory of the last time I saw you. I was being pulled out of a courtroom by two men with badges. I can't remember all the things I said to you, but I remember that I couldn't think of words strong enough to say at that moment. It's terrible to think that a mother can hate a son, but that day I hated you. As you know, I was high on meth at the time. I don't say that as an excuse. There is no excuse. I only say it to let you know that everything you believed about me was true. After they arrested me that day, I thought my life was over. I knew when they pulled me from the courtroom that I lost Jeremy. All I could think was that I was going to prison, and you were the reason why. I couldn't see that I had put myself there. I had committed every act that they accused me of, and I still could only see my downfall as being your fault. Somehow I was able to see everything that went wrong in my life as being your fault. I was sure that they were going to throw me in prison. The judge at my last probation violation hearing said that she was giving me one last chance, and if I blew it, she would have no choice. And so what did I do? I blew it. I got high in the middle of Jeremy's guardianship hearing. I didn't think I could function if I didn't have a hit. I thought I could get away with it. But you knew me too well. I am ashamed to say this next part, but I have to be honest. When you showed that video to the judge, I wished that I had never given birth to you. I saw your act as the greatest of betrayals. I know now that I was wrong. It may be hard to believe, may be impossible to believe, but you saved my life that day. After they arrested me, they charged me with my second controlled substance crime. I had thoughts of killing myself. I thought that if I committed suicide, I might make you feel guilty. I tried to picture your face when you learned that I had died because of your betrayal. In truth, though, I could never really convince myself that my death would make you feel bad at all. I have done terrible things to you and your brother, and I have no reason to expect that you would feel anything for me. When they brought me back to court, they offered me a way to stay out of prison. It was a program called Drug Court. They said it would take at least 18 months to complete, and more likely a couple of years. I would have to go to court once a week and do what they told me to do. I didn't know much about it, but as long as I didn't have to go to prison, I didn't care. I figured I could fake my way through anything. I was wrong. Early on, they made me go see a psychologist. I resisted, but deep down I knew that I was messed up. At first, things didn't go well. I hated everything about my psychologist, but then I got tired of fighting and I started talking. She was nice, and she didn't judge me. I told her things I've never told anyone, things I've never told you. It felt good to talk about it. She said that I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar. That explains why my whole life I felt like I was walking around with 1,000 short fuses in my head. I've made some big changes in my life. I got my driver's license now and a job. I'm in recovery and I've been sober for 4 years. That hit of meth that you saw me do was the last time I did anything. I haven't touched a drop of alcohol either. I know you are probably reading this and saying to yourself, what's her angle? But there is no angle. I am out of drug court now, and I go to meetings every week. I've been working the 12-step program and doing good. The one step that I've been dreading is the one I take now. I must reach out to those who I have harmed and offer to make amends. I want to make amends with you, yet I know that I do not deserve your forgiveness. So that is why I am writing to you today. I want to tell you and Lila and Jeremy how truly sorry I am for what I did. I was a terrible mother. And a terrible person for so many years. I do not expect to hear back from you. And if you don't respond, I'll understand, but I need you to know that I am sorry. I guess that's all I have to say. I will not contact you again. If you ever decide that you have it in your heart to forgive me, I'll be here with open arms. Your mother, Kathy. I folded the pages together again. my head thumping as the words in the letter pushed against my memory. I couldn't remember my mother ever speaking to me with such clarity. It almost read like someone else was telling her what to write. I thought about that for a moment. I guess that was a possibility. I read the letter again and felt the same confusion. I can't deny that I wanted to believe her. What son wouldn't want that person in the letter for a mother? But I had Jeremy to consider. I couldn't expose him to this new Kathy if the old Kathy still lurked in the corner. I had to know that the letter was genuine. I looked at the return address on the envelope and saw that she was still living in our old apartment. After everything that had happened in the intervening years, she was in the same place with the same landlord, Mr. Bremer. I still knew Mr. Bremer's number, and I typed it into my phone, pausing my thumb over the send button for a second before hitting it and making the call. Chapter 28. I hadn't been back to Austin since the guardianship hearing, and frankly, I hadn't planned on stepping foot in that town ever again. But as afternoon bled into evening, I found myself sitting at a cafe in downtown Austin, watching Jeremy eat pancakes and waiting for Terry Bremer to show up. I called him from Buckley to ask one simple question. Had my mother really changed? His answer? We should talk. I don't think Jeremy realized that we were in Austin, even when our mother's old landlord entered the cafe and walked over to our table. Bremer wore what looked to be the same flannel shirt he wore the last time I saw him so many years ago. But then again, I'd known Terry Bremer for most of my life, and I couldn't recall ever seeing him in anything other than a long-sleeved flannel shirt, even in the middle of summer. Hi, Mr. Bremer, I said, reaching out my hand. I think you can start calling me Terry, he answered, giving me a firm handshake. I could feel thick calluses on his palm, and it brought me back to the days when I worked for him as a teenager. My hands must have felt like sponges in his grip now, the hands of a thinker, not a doer, as he used to say. He slid into the booth opposite Jeremy and me. Hi, Jeremy, he said. Hi, Mr. Bremer, Jeremy said, not showing a hint of surprise. I opened my laptop and started a movie for Jeremy to watch so that Bremer and I could talk. With earbuds in his ears, Jeremy became insulated from our conversation. Then, I laid Kathy's letter on the table. Mom sent this to me, back in December. I didn't read it until today. I pointed at the return address. Is Mom still living at her old apartment? She is. Then you probably know what she's been up to over the past few years. I do, he said with a nod of his head. I've been keeping a close eye on her. You should probably know that I kicked her out of that apartment at one time. I try to be understanding, even when renters do a little jail time. She missed a lot of rent, and I overlooked it. But I kicked her out when she got that second possession charge, the one that came out of that guardianship hearing. You heard about that? I said. I heard her side of it. I think I have a pretty good idea of what happened. The bottom line was that I had to evict her. Bremer held his hands up in surrender. I had no choice. I had to bring the unlawful detainer action. I put her stuff in a storage unit. Your mother was in a bad way, and I agreed not to toss her stuff if she managed to stay out of prison. But if she went to prison, well, I can't pay to store her property for years. And yet she managed to wiggle her way back into the apartment? That's not exactly how it went, Joe. When I told her that I put her stuff in storage, she told me to just burn it. She thought she was going to prison and nothing mattered. Bremer looked at Jeremy, who was paying attention to his movie. Joe, what happened at that hearing tore her up inside. She always came across as tough and sometimes just flat out mean. But after that hearing, she was a whipped dog. She brought it all on herself, I said, my words sounding defensive, even to me. There's no doubt about that, he said. What happened to your mother wasn't your doing. In fact, I want to tell you how proud I am of you. I saw your mother heading for that cliff, but there's nothing you can do if a person doesn't want the help. That's just how it is. But you took your brother on. That had to be tough, and I respect you for it. I shrugged my shoulders. Sometimes, Joe, it takes the world crashing in around you to realize that you're not in control. Some addicts can't see any way out until they hit that rock bottom. When I went to see your mother in jail that day, I think she found her rock bottom.
Bremer reached up to his neck and lifted a silver chain up through his collar, a gold medallion hanging on the end of it. He unhooked the chain and handed it to me. The medallion, about the size of a half dollar, had a triangle in the center with XXV stamped in the middle. Around the edge of the medallion was the inscription, "To thine own self be true." Along the three sides of the triangle were the words unity, service, recovery. "I hit rock bottom over 25 years ago," he said. "It cost me my family, my job, everything." "I didn't know," I said. "Not many people do, but I wanted you to understand that I'm talking to you as someone who's been where your mother was."
"Where she was?"
"Well, maybe that was a poor choice of words. Addiction is a struggle. Most people think that the only thing you have to do to stop being an addict is to stop drinking or stop using. That's not the case. If you stop drinking, you may be sober, but you're just one bad day away from going back to the gutter. Recovery is a lifestyle. You have to change how you see the world and how you see yourself. That's what your mom's trying to do right now."
"So she could go back to being a meth head at any moment?"
"You see the problem, don't you, Terry?"
It felt strange addressing him by his first name. "I can't let her..."
I nodded toward Jeremy.
"I can't open that door again. Not unless I'm sure.
Joe, I could pick up a bottle of beer tomorrow and I'd be back in the hole that I spent 25 years climbing out of. No one can give you a guarantee."
"But I'm responsible for him."
I again nodded at Jeremy.
"I can't just forget everything and trust her. It doesn't work that way."
"I understand," he said. "It takes time. It took me some time to trust her again. I didn't just let her walk back into that apartment. In fact, I rented it to another family for 2 years. When your mom got out of jail, the court put her into a halfway house, then a sober house. They helped her get a job, and she's really good at it."
"What does she do?"
"She works for me," Bremer smiled. "She's my bookkeeper."
"Bookkeeper? Like, she handles money?"
"She does. She collects rent, pays the bills, she does it all."
"You trust her with cash?"
"Joe, when I hit my rock bottom, I was fired for stealing tools from my employer. I have a felony conviction for theft, so I know what it's like trying to find a job when the world has you branded a certain way. I saw that your mother was trying. I gave her a chance, and she's come a long way."
"That's why you let her back into her old apartment?"
"Not completely."
Terry had his fingers laced together on the table, and he looked me in the eye as he spoke, glancing away occasionally when he needed to draw upon a memory.
"She worked for me, so she knew that the apartment had become vacant. When she asked me to let her move back in, I hesitated."
"So you don't fully trust her yet?"
"It wasn't that, not really. Going back to your old haunts can be a bad idea. Those places have ghosts, memories. Why take the risk? I didn't think it was a good idea for her to move back into her old apartment, and I said so. But she told me that she needed to do it. She needed to face her past. Either she would be strong enough, or she wouldn't. Her ghosts are you boys. She can't run from that by changing apartments. She had to face it head on."
"And how did it go?"
"She's been there a year, and I've never seen her stronger."
I tried to picture my mother as a strong person, and couldn't.
"Joe, I can't tell you what to do. You have to make the decision on your own. But I gave your mother another chance, and I don't regret it."
"You don't have an autistic brother to worry about, though."
"True enough," he said. "But if you want to see for yourself, Kathy's going to be at an AA meeting tonight in the basement of Grace Lutheran. Starts at 7:30. As it happens, I'm the scheduled speaker this evening. It's an open meeting, so you're welcome to join."
"She'll be there?"
"Come see for yourself."
Jeremy pulled his earbuds out and spoke for the first time since Bremer arrived.
"I think I have to go to the bathroom," he said.
"Sure," I said, sliding out of the booth. I walked Jeremy most of the way to the men's room and stood by to make sure he went through the correct door. Then I returned to the booth where Bremer was standing.
"I know it's hard to make a leap this big," he said. "There's been a lot of history. Just keep in mind that people can change. I did."
I nodded, not wanting to argue. Bremer held out his hand, and I shook it.
"It's good to see you again," he said. "And I meant what I said. I'm proud of you." I really am. If you decide to leave well enough alone, I'll certainly understand. And this little meeting of ours... He waved his finger above the booth where we'd been sitting. Your mother will never know about it unless you tell her. I appreciate that, I said. Bremer gave me a tight-lipped smile, patted my shoulder, and walked away. Chapter 29. I drove to a park on the north side of Austin to ponder the minefield, the many minefields, before me. Was I crazy for even considering going to the meeting? I'd fought so hard to get that woman out of our lives. And I had done it. I had won. Lila, Jeremy, and I were a family, just the three of us. I knew that I should just hit the road and make the 2-hour trip back to Buckley. But every time I committed to leave Austin, I would hear Lila's voice telling me that there's no such thing as a lost cause. Lila had read Kathy's letter. She had talked to Kathy on the phone, and she believed that my mother had changed. Bremer believed it too. They were wrong. I would wield one hell of an I told you so. But in all honesty, I didn't want to be right about this. I didn't want my mother to be the mess I remembered. It seemed to me that the only way to put this tug of war to rest would be to go to that AA meeting. At 7:30, I rolled up 6th Avenue and parked across the street from Grace Lutheran Church, far enough away to be inconspicuous, but close enough that I could watch people drift in from the parking lot. I didn't see Kathy, but I saw Terry Bremer. As he approached the church doors, he stopped and turned, scanning the assortment of parked cars, until he spotted me in the distance. Then he smiled, nodded, and headed inside. A few more stragglers made their way in before the parking lot fell quiet. I couldn't leave Jeremy alone in the car, but taking him with me carried an enormous risk. How would he react if he saw his mother? I would need to find a place where we could eavesdrop and not be seen. And Jeremy would need to obey me without arguing or fighting. This undertaking had calamity written all over it. Yet, for better or worse, I had to go in. I turned to Jeremy. Remember how sometimes in the movies people go into churches and they have to be very quiet? He nodded. You see that church over there? I pointed. He nodded again. We're going to go in there for just a little bit, and I need you to be very quiet. Can you do that? Maybe I can. I mean, no talking at all. You understand? Maybe I'll be very quiet for you, Joe. Great, and stay by my side, okay? He didn't answer. My watch read 7:38 as we made our way to the church. The meeting would be started already. With everyone in their seats, they might not notice a couple guys slipping in through the back. We stepped inside the entrance, and light spilling from a doorway to my left caught my attention. I could hear voices coming through that door, and I motioned for Jeremy to follow me. The doorway led to a set of stairs and a basement. From the top step, I could hear a woman, not Kathy, making announcements about an upcoming sober camping trip. The stairs were open on the sides, except for the wooden spindles and handrails, and if we stayed on the top step, we'd be out of the view of the people below. I put my finger to my lips to tell Jeremy to keep quiet, and we sat down. From there, we could hear the meeting as if we were in the same room. As Jeremy took his seat beside me, my phone dinged a single chime. Text message. I forgot to put my phone on silent. Gritting my teeth, I pulled my phone out, silenced the ringer, and looked at the number. I didn't recognize the caller. Tonight's speaker, the woman below said, is someone we all know. He's kind of the rock of this group. I read the text on my phone. Are you the reporter? I typed back, yes. Who is this? As I waited for the reply, I turned my attention again to the speaker. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Terry B. The smattering of claps suggested that there were around 20 people in the basement of the church. I looked at my phone again. This is Moody. You want to talk? I nearly dropped my phone. I quickly typed, yes. Call me. Then I switched my phone to vibrate, stood up, and motioned for Jeremy to follow me outside so I could take the call. Moody Lynch, the fugitive, was about to contact me. I wasn't prepared. My head wasn't in the right place, but I'd be damned if I was going to miss this opportunity. I motioned again, but Jeremy didn't move. My phone buzzed. Not over the phone, in person, tomorrow, 1:00. I'll text you where to go. Then a few seconds later, another text. No cops. From below, I could hear Terry Bremer's voice.
Thank you. My name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
I sat back down beside Jeremy.
Moody wants to meet in person. That wasn't the plan. This was supposed to be a simple conversation over the phone.
I typed my reply.
Bad idea. Why would I meet with someone accused of murder? Call me.
Terry Bremer had one of those deep, soothing voices, the kind that should belong to an aging country singer. He said,
I know I'm supposed to be talking to you tonight, but I have a favor to ask everyone here, and one person in particular. I've heard Kathy N. tell her story before. There are some new folks here who I think would be truly inspired by listening to her, so if she'd be willing, I would love to have her take my place at the lectern. Would that be okay, Kathy?
There was a hushed mumbling, and then I heard my mother speak.
I haven't prepared anything. I'm not sure.
I looked at Jeremy's face, trying to gauge his reaction to hearing his mother's voice for the first time in years. At first he looked confused, as if trying to place it. Then his eyes came to rest on some blemish on the wall ahead of us, his expression reminiscent of someone straining to hear a dying whisper.
Bremer said, Kathy, I would be honored if you would tell your story in my place. Please?
I guess I could, she said.
My phone buzzed again, and I looked at the message.
I didn't kill anyone. If you are Angel's brother, then you need to hear what I have to say. I love her and won't harm you. Just no cops.
I didn't want to argue with Moody at that moment. Kathy was about to speak, and what she had to say mattered to me more than the logistics of my meeting with Moody Lynch. I sent a quick answer back to Moody. Okay. Telling myself that I could always change my mind later, after I had time to give it some thought. From below, my mother's words, sad and quiet, climbed the stairs to where Jeremy and I sat.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy, and I'm an alcoholic and a meth addict.
Those words sent an unexpected chill through me, her cold admission putting into words the source of much of my own pain. But I shook off my reaction. They were just words. The dogma of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no doubt that Kathy could chant a pretty convincing liturgy if she needed to. One thing I knew for certain about my mother was that she could fake it with the best of them. I gathered my skepticism back up around my shoulders and waited.
I didn't plan to speak tonight, she said. I usually have time to get my head right, so please bear with me if I stumble a bit.
She paused, and I could hear her taking deep breaths. Then she began with,
I used to be the mother of two beautiful boys, Joe and Jeremy.
When Jeremy heard Kathy say his name, he began to stand up. I tugged at the sleeve of his shirt to pull him back to the step. He sat on the very edge and began rubbing his right thumb against the knuckles of his left hand, his eyes again locked on the wall ahead.
This was a bad idea.
And because I chose my addiction over them, I haven't seen either of them or spoken to them in a long time.
I fully expected my mother to whitewash our shared history, those parts of her life that I had experienced and could refute. I readied myself for a tale of how she'd been wronged by her defiant and selfish son, and how the system had it in for her. I waited for the excuses and the half-truths, and quite frankly, the lies. She didn't know that Jeremy and I were hiding on the steps. She could paint our past with any color she chose.
But Kathy didn't whitewash her story.
She spoke slowly and honestly about the shipwreck that had been our lives. Sometimes she would pause to choke back her emotions as she talked about her drinking and leaving us boys alone. I could hear her rawness in her words as she told those gathered that she had come to see her children as a burden.
I thought of my sons as stones around my neck, she said. It's a terrible thing to admit, but I believed that if I didn't have them in my life, I'd be happier.
Her words began to falter and lose their footing, so she paused again. When she was able to continue, she said,
And then it all came to a head one night. when I watched a man hit my autistic son, Jeremy. It was a man that I was dating at the time. We had been doing meth, and we were drinking, and when he hit Jeremy, I did nothing.
Her sobs cut into her words, and she stopped again to take another deep breath.
He punched my son in the face with his fist, and all I could do was make excuses for why it was okay.
She pushed ahead, her voice rising in pitch as her emotions peaked.
I was his mother. I was supposed to protect him. I should have done something. I should have called the police. But all I could think was that I didn't want to be alone.
Kathy fought to hold it together, taking another pause in her story. Jeremy had stopped rubbing his hand, his eyes now cast down to the bottom of the stairs, his face pinched like he was trying to piece together a puzzle that had no picture. After Kathy regained her composure, she said,
"That night, my son Joe came and took his brother away for good. You'd think something like that would be enough to turn your life around, but for me, it wasn't."
An edge of anger began to grow in Kathy's voice.
"I got arrested for possessing methamphetamine, and that wasn't enough. My son sued me for guardianship of his brother and won, and that wasn't enough. I still thought I'd get through probation and go back to using. I knew that I could beat the system. None of those things were going to change me because the harder the world pushed at me, the harder I was going to push back."
Mom's angry tone fell away.
"But then, one day, I was walking home from an appointment with my psychologist, and I stopped at a park to rest. There, I saw these two boys playing, and one of the boys, the younger brother, had Down syndrome. It struck me how caring and protective the older brother was. I became mesmerized by them. And when it came time to leave, the older brother picked up his younger brother's coat and helped him put it on. When he did that, a memory came to me, something I had forgotten a long time ago. Joey had to be maybe 8 and Jeremy 6. I was taken to my father's house so he could watch them while I was out drinking. I remember that I was in a rush, and I was yelling at the boys to hurry up. We walked out of the house, and I was holding both their hands, but Joey pulled free and ran back into the house. It was cold that day, and I yelled at Joey. I mean, I really laid into him for making me wait in the chill. When Joey came back out, he carried Jeremy's winter coat."
My mother's voice shook with emotion as she struggled to keep going.
"I had dragged Jeremy out into the cold without his coat. Joe brought it out and helped Jeremy put it on. That day in the park, when that memory came back to me, I started to cry. I ran home, my eyes so full of tears that I could barely see. I ran to my bedroom and sat on the floor in the corner, and I cried and cried and cried. It was as if all the mistakes I'd made came flooding back to me. I saw what I had done and what I had missed out on for all those years. I couldn't stop crying because for the first time in my life, I was able to see who I really was, and it hurt."
Jeremy leaned forward, like he wanted to stand up. I think he was waiting to see if I would pull him back. I didn't.
"I lost my boys,"
my mother said, her words breaking under the weight of our history.
"I loved alcohol more than I loved them. I loved meth more. I had everything I needed to be happy. They were right in front of me the whole time. All I had to do was open my eyes and see them."
I stood and walked with Jeremy down the stairs.
"My addiction robbed me of..."
Kathy stopped mid-sentence, her mouth frozen open. She stared at us as if she were unable to understand what she was seeing. She brought her fingers to her mouth, a muffled wail escaping her lips. Her knees buckled beneath her, and Terry rushed forward to help her to the floor. Others in the room turned around to see what had caused their speaker to collapse. Many of them had already been crying, moved by Kathy's story. When they saw us, they quickly put two and two together, and pretty soon, it seemed like no one in the room had a dry eye. except for Jeremy.
Chapter 30. Jeremy and I, materializing in the back of the AA meeting the way we did, brought the whole proceeding to a screeching halt. Jeremy walked up to Kathy and said hello as though he'd just seen her yesterday. Mom then gave Jeremy a light hug, keeping it short because Jeremy doesn't like hugs. I stayed in the back of the room and waited as Bremer led Kathy and Jeremy out. We headed up the stairs and out of the church, none of us having any idea what to do next. Once outside, the evening became thick with unspoken conversations as we stood next to one another making awkward small talk. Finally, it was Bremer who suggested that Jeremy and I accompany our mother back to her apartment. Walking into my old home, the apartment where I last shared a meal with my mother and my brother so many years ago, made my knees a little shaky, like that feeling you get as adrenaline starts to leave the fibers of your muscles. It looked the same, yet it looked different. Gone were the dishes stacked high in the sink, clothing hanging over the backs of chairs, the subtle aroma of decay born of a want of vacuuming. Kathy now owned a couch devoid of drink stains, and all around were items that seemed out of place. Fragile china figurines, porcelain vases, glass bowls of potpourri, things that would never have survived in our old world. Mom looked different, too. She had cut her hair short, the flowing locks of her youth replaced by a simple bob that gave her face a soft frame. In that one simple act, it was as if she had signaled to the world that she was done seeking attention and instead wanted to be taken seriously. Mom turned on the television for Jeremy and put on an old movie into her DVD player, The Lion King.
"I bet you haven't watched this in a while," she said to him.
Jeremy pulled his chin into his chest as he considered her question and then said, "Maybe it has been a long time." He sat on the couch to watch the movie, his back straight and his hands on his knees. Kathy nodded toward the kitchen table. I followed her there, and we sat and stared at each other for an uncomfortable few moments. I wanted to say something nice, but the only thing that came to mind was to compliment her on cleaning up her act, and that sounded more like an insult when I practiced it in my head. I'm sure she was having a similar struggle. Finally, it was Kathy who spoke.
"I guess you could tell by my reaction that I wasn't expecting you tonight."
You can thank Terry Bremer for that. I think he knew that we were listening in the back. That's why he wanted you to tell your story.
I'm glad he did it.
I didn't know you were such a good speaker, I said.
I didn't either. It's just something you do when you go through recovery, I guess. You want to tell others how you screwed up and maybe they can learn from your mistakes.
I wanted to be comforting and tell her that she wasn't that bad of a mother, but we both would have known that to be a lie. As I watched this stranger across the table from me, I felt the need to be careful in my words. I didn't want to say something that might cause her to unravel and revert back to the Kathy of my youth.
"How is Lila?"
Kathy asked. "She's great," I said. I didn't see any need to go into the difficulties pressing down on Lila and me at the moment.
"She's a sweet girl. She called me a while back. Did you know that?"
"Yes," I said, doing little to hide my displeasure.
"I hope you're not mad at her about that."
I shook my head.
"She said she's studying to be a lawyer. I didn't know that she wanted to be a lawyer. Or if I did know it, I don't remember. I don't remember a lot of what I should. It's strange how your mind really does heal once you get off everything. They used to tell me that kind of thing in treatment. They said it took time, but I never gave it time. Probably took 2 years for the fog to fully lift.
Well, you're looking healthy."
"Thanks. I feel healthy. I'm in therapy now."
Bremer told me about that, but I acted like I didn't know.
"They have me on lithium."
"Lithium? Isn't that like a major medication?"
"It is. I've been living with bipolar for most of my life, and there's the PTSD stemming from my mom's death."
I knew that Grandma Nelson died when Mom was still in high school, but in my youth, that tragedy, a car accident, never seemed to carry any weight.
My grandmother's death and her absence from our lives seemed to be little more than the ammunition my mother used to show what an ungrateful wretch I was, how I had it so much better than she did because I had a mother. There's a lot about her death that I never told anyone, not even my father. I thought I left it behind, but that's the thing I'm learning in therapy. Stuff like that doesn't go away.
Can you talk about it now? I asked, as gently as I could. Kathy looked at the table between us, her eyes locked on a memory far away, her fingers folding together like someone about to enter into a prayer. Then she said,
I was a senior in high school on the volleyball team, and we were playing regionals. Mom didn't really like coming to my games. I think if she had her way, she would have stayed at home so she could watch TV and drink wine.
My mother looked at me with a wry smile.
I'm afraid this apple didn't fall very far from that tree.
I didn't let myself respond in any way.
I threw a fit that day, Kathy said. I screamed at her and told her that if she didn't come watch me play, she could just give up on being my mom, because I was going to give up on being her daughter. We said a lot of terrible things to each other that day. Your grandpa usually refereed our arguments, kept us from going too far, but he wasn't there that time.
Kathy got up, pulled some tissues from a box in the kitchen, and returned to the table, touching a tissue to the corners of her eyes.
My mother came to the tournament, but not before drinking enough wine to get her through the evening. I was standing outside the gym, warming up, practicing my bumps and sets with some other girls, when we heard this terrible screeching sound and a crash.
She paused to take a few breaths to calm herself.
I saw the smoke and ran toward it. When I got there, one of the cars was already on fire. That's when I saw my mother, slumped over in the driver's seat of the burning car. I screamed and ran toward her door, but before I could get there, the car erupted in flames.
Lost in her story, my mother stopped dabbing at the tears that now flowed down her cheeks.
I watched my mother die, burned to death. I know she was unconscious, and all I could do was pray that she didn't feel the flames. Her autopsy showed that she was drunk when she blew the stop sign. Thank God the other woman lived.
Kathy's hands remained folded together, limp, inches away from my hand. I slowly reached out and laid my fingers on hers. I think this surprised her because she gave a short inhale and then smiled through her tears.
I never told my father about the argument we had that day. I didn't want him to know that it was my fault Mom drove drunk. Her death was my fault.
That's not true, though, I said. You understand that, don't you? My mother wrapped her hands around mine and gave a squeeze.
I know, she said. But that's how I saw it for all these years.
She gave a slight chuckle to relieve the tension.
You have no idea how messed up I was.
I smiled. I had some idea. She turned serious again.
I want to thank you for what you did.
What I did?
She gave a nod toward Jeremy. You saved Jeremy's life. That day you took him out of here, I think deep down I was glad. I knew that things were getting out of hand with Larry. It was only a matter of time before Larry would take the abuse to another level. I knew that.
I was just acting on emotion. I didn't mean to mess his knee up, I said, although I really didn't believe that.
Good riddance to him,
Kathy said.
Except I always thought this was a temporary thing, you taking Jeremy. I thought I'd get myself together and we'd go back to how it was. But then you sued me for guardianship.
I braced for the impact.
If you hadn't done that, I don't know what might have happened to Jeremy.
My shoulders relaxed.
He needed someone to take care of him, and I couldn't even take care of myself. I'm so proud of you, Joe, and I can't tell you how happy I am right now. I never thought I'd see you and Jeremy again. Can you stay for a while? Or are you going back to the Twin Cities tonight?
Actually, Jeremy and I are staying in Buckley.
Buckley?
Joe Talbert Sr. died there on Tuesday night. Did you know he was living in Buckley? She pulled her hands back from mine.
Joe's dead? I didn't know. How did you... I mean, have you been in contact with him?
I found out through a press release. He was... well, someone killed him. Kathy picked up her tissues and wadded them together in her palm, her eyes lost in a kind of melancholy haze.
It doesn't surprise me that he died that way, she said. He wasn't a very nice man.
Was he really my father?
What do you mean?
I considered telling her about the money, but quickly decided to keep that information to myself. Things were complicated enough already. I mean, is there a possibility that he's not my biological father? She didn't answer right away, and I could see in her eyes that my question struck a nerve.
He's your father.
She sounded less than sure. Is there any chance he's not?
Joe, I wasn't in a very good place at that point in my life. That's no excuse. I did a lot of foolish things. I found my worth in the eyes of the men I was with.
Her cheeks flushed pink as she fumbled with her explanation.
It's a hard thing to say, especially to your own son, but there were a number of men in my life back then. It's hard to know 100%, but I'm sure that Joe was your father.
But not 100% sure.
Joe, please don't.
Did you know his brother Charlie? Kathy grimaced, as if the name alone was enough to put a bitter taste in her mouth.
Charlie Talbert is a vile human being. I'm doing my best to see the good in people now that I'm in recovery, but that man.
I heard that Joe and Charlie didn't get along.
Joe hated Charlie. How come?
Mom gave me a look, as if to say, don't make me go down that rabbit hole. Then she wiped her nose on a tissue, licked her lips, and nodded.
People always thought that it was because Charlie was everything Joe wasn't. Smart, successful, polished. Back in high school, Charlie was one of those boys who seemed to come out on top no matter what. They were both bad boys, but Charlie was the one you dated so you could brag to your girlfriends about it. Joe was the guy you settled for.
I could see a wave of regret building up in my mother's eyes.
I found all this out when I was dating Joe. But Charlie had a secret, something that his family kept hidden from everyone. Their mother used to babysit for extra cash, kind of an illegal daycare. And Joe and Charlie used to help. One day, Joe walked in on Charlie molesting one of the children, a little girl named Poppy Sanchez. She lived on the same street as me growing up. Charlie was a teenager, and Poppy was only 6 or 7 at that time.
Holy crap, I whispered.
Yeah. Joe freaked out and told his mother, but nothing happened. His parents swept the whole thing under the rug. Charlie went on living his charmed life, no consequences. And he never seemed to regret what he did to Poppy.
Then Mom took on a questioning expression, leaning in and asking,
do they think Charlie killed Joe? That wouldn't surprise me.
They don't think so. Turns out the people who wanted Joe Talbert dead make up a pretty long list. Everybody thought he was an asshole. Their words, not mine.
I suppose he was that, and more.
And yet you named me after him. I could hear the accusation in my voice. Between the two of us, I was the one slipping into old patterns. But Kathy didn't react the way she would have in the past. She took a slow breath in and out. Then she did it again and said,
Joe, I have caused a great deal of harm in my life to many people, not the least of which is you and your brother. I have a lot on my plate, and I'm dealing with it as best I can. One day at a time, as we say. Can we have this discussion later? I just want to enjoy being with you and Jeremy tonight.
I felt bad about trying to get that jab in.
I'm sorry. You're right. Do you have to go back to Buckley tonight?
Well, I still have your old bunk bed.
I don't know. I'm sorry, she said. I shouldn't have.
I hadn't thought this through. How did I not see her request coming? I looked around the apartment at the traces of this new life my mother had been forging. Nothing I saw hinted that the old Kathy might be lurking behind the quiet smile of this new woman. But I had been proven wrong before. I wanted to be outside of my mother's influence as I considered this new wrinkle.
I need to run an errand, I said.
That was a lie.
Can you watch Jeremy for a little bit?
My mother beamed at that and didn't have to answer. I left Kathy's apartment and drove through Austin, curling around old and familiar places, drawing from them the memories of why I shouldn't leave Jeremy with my mother. But the woman in that apartment bore little resemblance to the woman who cursed my birth after the guardianship hearing. My mother had changed. Bremer saw it. Lila saw it. And, if I were being honest, I saw it too. I had already crossed one line by letting Jeremy see his mother. Would crossing another one be all that bad? And if I could leave Jeremy with Kathy, it would help me in all kinds of ways. Where would Jeremy stay if I decided to meet with Moody Lynch? I couldn't leave him in the motel again. If she could keep it together for a couple days, I might have things worked out. And if she fell apart, well, I'd just have to cross that bridge if it happened. Before going back to Kathy's, I stopped at a store and bought Jeremy enough clothes to last him a few days, and a green toothbrush. When I got back in my car, I called Lila, my call going straight to voicemail. Hi, Lila. You're not going to believe this, but I'm in Austin, of all places. I wanted to let you know that you were right about my mother. It's a long story, but Jeremy and I are spending the night at her apartment, and then I'm going back to Buckley in the morning. It'll be strange not having him with either one of us for a night. I can't remember a time when it was you and me without him being there. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I just wanted to say that you were right to keep the letter, and I'm really sorry that I made such a case of it. I'm sorry about a lot of things. I hope the studying's going well, and I really miss you. Chapter 31. The next morning I got started for Buckley a little later than I had hoped. Kathy made a breakfast of pancakes and bacon and eggs. Actual food. Jeremy and I grew up on a menu of fast and easy. Anything microwavable or box ready. Sure, we had the occasional home-cooked meal. But I could only remember a handful, and even then, the quality of the cooking was questionable. I think what surprised me most that morning was the real maple syrup. The rest of the meal could be faked, but to have real maple syrup in the cupboard ready to go meant that Kathy probably made pancakes on a regular basis, and not just to impress us. In my last text with Moody Lynch, I had agreed to meet him face to face, telling myself that I could always back out of it. Now I had 2 hours of drive time to decide. I'd been down that path once before, going to meet with someone who might be a murderer, and I just about lost my life over it. My experience and my good sense were both telling me not to go. But there was something in his text that tipped the scale in his favor. His last text read in part, "If you are Angel's brother, then you need to hear what I have to say." Those didn't seem to be the words of a man setting a trap. Why would he think that I needed to hear what he had to say if he planned on killing me? He had no quarrel with me. It sounded like he genuinely wanted to talk, nothing more. I struggled with my decision as I headed back to Buckley. Around mid-morning, I stopped in a town half an hour east of Buckley and bought a couple ham sandwiches, one for me and one to give to Moody as a show of goodwill. And just like that, I had made my decision. Because I had promised Jeb that I would call him if Moody contacted me, I dialed his number as soon as I got back on the road.
Jeb here?
Hi, Jeb. It's Joe Talbert.
Hey, Joe.
I got a text from Moody Lynch yesterday. He wants to meet.
Meet? As in face to face?
Yes.
Pause.
I don't think that's wise.
I know, but I've given it some thought, and I'm going to meet with him. I'm only calling you because I told you I would.
Where are you meeting?
You're kidding, right?
Joe, tell me where you're meeting, and I'll bring him in peacefully. He won't be hurt, I promise.
If he sees a cop, he'll be gone, you know that. Besides, I don't know where we're meeting. All I know is that the meeting will be at 1 o'clock today. I just wanted you to know that, in case
anything goes wrong.
Nothing's going to go wrong.
If you believed that, you wouldn't be calling.
I'm calling because I told you I'd call. Besides, I wanted to see if I can offer Moody anything to bring him in. I suppose immunity is out of the question?
Completely.
He doesn't trust you locals. If I could get him to agree, could he turn himself into, maybe, the state patrol?
Joe, he could do that now if he wanted to.
Tell him that we only want to talk. You won't arrest him?
You know I can't promise that. Well, I guess I'll just have to hear him out and let you know what he says.
We can rig you up with a wire so you could...
I'm not going to wear a wire. I'm not working for you.
There was a pause on the other end as Jeb, I assume, tried to come up with some way to insert himself in my plan. He must have come up empty because he said,
I can't condone what you're doing.
I'm not asking you to.
Would you at least check in here as soon as you're done? I'd really appreciate it.
Sure, Jeb. My phone beeped in my ear, and I looked and saw that there was a text message waiting.
I gotta go,
I said, and killed my call to Jeb.
I pulled onto a field approach to read the text. Two strings of numbers and nothing more. The text came from Moody, but it made no sense. Then it hit me. They were GPS coordinates. I had never tried it before, but I typed the GPS coordinates into the navigation app on my phone. And to my surprise, it gave me directions to a spot about 20 miles north of Buckley. The drive took me around the outskirts of town, which was good because I didn't want Jeb or Nathan spotting me and tailing me. As I neared the dot on the map, fields gave way to patches of woods, so I knew that I was close to the river again. I drove down a mildly sloping gravel road and could see the river ahead of me, the road turning to run parallel to the bank. After about 200 yards, my navigation system announced that I had arrived at my destination. I stopped the car and got out. The only structure in sight was a barn about 100 yards down the road, half hidden in a patch of overgrown scrub. He could be in the barn, or he could be hiding in the trees down closer to the river. If it were me, I'd be in the barn with the woods behind me in case I had to make a quick exit. I was about to get back into my car when my phone rang. In the sun, I couldn't see the number, so I answered. Hello? Nothing. Not even breathing. Hello? I said again. I thought maybe the connection had died on me. I killed the call. I waited for a minute in case they called back, but my phone remained silent. I looked around again, this time listening as hard as I could, straining to hear the sound of someone who might be crawling through the cornfield or the rustling leaves in the woods, but I heard nothing. I grabbed the sandwiches out of the car and started walking to the barn. I hate old barns. The Minnesota countryside is littered with them, and each one could send a jolt of panic through me stronger than anything a scary movie could do. I had nearly died outside of an old barn once. I had nearly lost Lila there. Now I stood at the entrance of yet another one, a bag of sandwiches in my hand, and my heart pumping harder than it should have been. It's strange how the structure itself could instill more fear in me than the possibility of meeting a murderer inside. I summoned my resolve, took a deep breath, and walked in. Sunlight cut through the gaps in the boards, painting stripes on the ground in front of me. Dust clung to the walls and floated through the air, twinkling in the thin rays of light. If old had a smell, that barn had captured it. Nothing hung on the walls, although I could see wooden pegs and tenpenny nails sticking out where stuff used to hang. At the other end of the barn, a ladder climbed up through an opening leading to the hayloft. Moody? I called out. No answer. Moody? I said again, listening for any sound and hearing nothing. Maybe he was down by the river. I turned to leave and heard,
Stay put.
The low, slow delivery stopped me in my tracks.
Did you come alone?
His call came up from up in the hayloft. I turned around and saw no one. I came alone. Are you Moody Lynch?
Boards creaked somewhere in the back of the loft, and a tall, thin figure rose to his feet. He stood in the shadows for a second, then stepped forward to where a pillar of light fell through a hole in the roof. His right arm hung heavy at his side, and as he walked to the edge of the hayloft, I could see the gun.
Oh, hell no, I said. It doesn't work that way.
Doesn't work what way?
No guns. I didn't bring one. I came here in good faith. You put that thing down or I'm out of here.
In my head, I was calculating my retreat. 5, maybe 6 paces to the door at a dead run. Could he hit me in that time? He'd have a pretty good chance. As long as it took more than one bullet to stop me, I'd make it out. Keep running. Get to the car. Get to the highway.
You don't make the rules here, he said.
You want to get your story out? Then you put that gun down, otherwise I'm leaving.
I took a step back to see if he would raise the gun. He didn't. I took another step.
Wait,
he said.
Fine. No guns.
He leaned over and dropped the weapon to the deck of the hayloft with a thud.
Just wait there. I'll be right down.
I let out the breath I'd been holding. Chapter 32. Moody Lynch was a string bean of a kid, a good 6 inches taller than me, but he couldn't have weighed more than 160. He wore a patch of bruises along the left side of his face and a thin scab on his bottom lip. The bruising and his hard eyes gave him age, but his thin beard, a sprinkling of whiskers that poked out, scruffy like the hair on a pig's back, worked against that age. Behind the wear and tear of it, he had a kind face, although it might have looked a little bit kinder had he bothered to close his slack jaw. Sandwich? I said, tossing him the bag.
Thanks. You're Joe, right?
Joe Talbert. Junior, technically. He opened the bag and pulled a sandwich out.
Are you wired, Joe?
I'm not working for the cops, I said. I came here on my own.
You mind opening your shirt and showing me?
He took a huge bite out of his sandwich, and I thought him oddly casual eating my food while he had me stripped to prove I wasn't wired. I opened my shirt and turned in a circle to prove my sincerity. But this conversation is on the record, Moody. You understand that, don't you? Anything you say is fair game for me to report.
Yeah, I get that. Are you really Angel's brother?
I don't know for sure, I said, buttoning my shirt back up. I'm leaning toward yes. Were you out at Toke's place that night?
Toke's place? It's hard to think of it as Toke's place. That no good bastard didn't deserve it.
But you were there. You sent a text to Angel saying you were meeting her. He looked confused for a second and then said,
Aw, hell! I forgot about that.
Why did you go to the farm?
Angel needed me.
But Toke threatened to kill you if he ever found you out there.
You ever been in love, Joe?
I suppose.
Then you know that some things are worth the risk. They are worth anything. That's how I feel about Angel. I met her when I was in town one day getting some parts from Dubs. She was there bringing something to Toke, or getting something from him, I don't remember. When I saw her, I couldn't help what I felt. You ever met Angel?
I went to the hospital to visit her a couple days ago.
How is she?
Moody's eyes lit up.
Is she going to be okay?
They don't know. She's in a coma.
My mom heard that, but we didn't know for sure.
Do you know what happened to her that night?
No. I mean, I know something happened, but I'm not sure what.
What do you mean?
She'd been acting really strange those last couple days. It was like she had a secret that she couldn't tell me. I asked her about it. I said, "What's gotten into you lately?" All she would say was she couldn't talk about it. Not yet, at least. I think that's why she wanted me to come over that night.
Did she say that?
No, but I talked to her earlier and she was really nervous. She said she was on her way to the sheriff's office to talk to Jeb Lewis about something, that she would call me later.
Did she call you?
That's when I got the text. Said she was freaking out and she needed me to come over. We were going to meet in the horse barn. That's where we always met. She would sneak out after Toke fell asleep.
What time did you go over there?
Just ahead of midnight. I parked my truck at the boat launch a mile away and took the path up through the woods.
The boat launch under the bridge?
Yep. There's an old horse trail that follows the edge of the field and brings you up behind the barn.
I normally sneak in through the back door, but the light was on. The light's never on in that barn.
I thought Toke might have left it on by accident, so I waited outside for a while.
Moody stopped talking and straightened up like a deer hearing the break of a twig. We both stood perfectly still, listening to the nothingness around us. He looked at me out of the corner of his eye.
Are you sure you weren't followed?
I'm sure, I said. The highway has a long, straight section a few miles back. If anyone was within 5 miles of me, I would have seen them.
I was watching the sky as you pulled up. There weren't any airplanes either.
It never dawned on me to look up at the sky. I probably wouldn't make it as a fugitive.
Anyway, I opened the barn door real slow-like and peeked in. I saw something on the ground near the front door.
I didn't know what it was, so I eased in and closed the door. I was listening to hear if Toke was around, and that's when I heard her moan.
Heard who moan?
Angel.
Angel?
Yeah. She was the thing I saw on the ground. I mean, I didn't know that at first. I just heard the moan.
How was she? Describe her to me.
She was wearing her normal clothes and everything, but she was just lying there moaning. I thought maybe she fell or something. I bent down to look at her, you know, see if she hit her head, but I didn't see any marks. I tried to wake her. I had her in my arms and I was shaking her and she wouldn't wake up. That's when I heard,